This program was first broadcast on Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. For more information on Fresh FM, as well as links to other great local programs, go to our website, freshfm.net, or download the Access Internet Radio app.
Hello and welcome. I'm Galen Pound, and you're listening to Top Writers. My guest today is former journalist for the Nelson Mail and Radio Nelson, as well as many other organisations, Karen Stade. Karen has curated exhibitions for the Nelson Provincial Museum, as well as being a writer and researcher for them. She is also a writer and researcher for The Prow, a history website for the Top of the South Libraries. Karen's written several books, including Meet You at the Church Steps, A Social History of a Nelson Landmark, and with Karen Price, Pastor, Prayer and Promise, The Story of Nelson's Italian Community, 1860 to 2014. Karen has received several awards for her work, including the Queen's Service Medal for services to historical research in the community. Her latest book, which was launched last month, is Driven by the Wind, the memoir of Captain Henry Rose, published by River Press. Welcome to Top Writers, Karen.
Thank you, Galen. It's lovely to be back with Fresh FM.
Right, before we talk about your latest book, could you please explain what the difference is between a memoir and an autobiography or a biography?
Well, I guess I actually did a bit of research, Galen, because that you mentioned that when we talked about doing this interview, and it got me thinking. And I kind of thought an autobiography is far more fact-based and chronological and, you know, researched, I think, by a person about themselves, obviously. Whereas a memoir is more emotional and memories of a life. So indeed, that is what my, you know, when I Googled, that's what it came up with. So a memoir is how one remembers one's own life, while an autobiography is history requiring research, dates, facts, double-checked. And that's from Gore Vidal. But I rather like this one. It used to be simple. Famous people wrote autobiographies. Nobodies wrote memoirs.
I love that.
It's fabulous, isn't it?
Thank you for clarifying that. Now, tell us a little bit about the book and how you got involved.
Well, this is a book that has nothing to do with Nelson. And so it's one of the few I've written that has no link here at all. But the connection is Captain Henry Rose's great-grandson, Alistair Rose, who is a retired orchardist in Mapua. And he had the copy of his great-grandfather's memoir. And a whole lot of stuff about Henry, silver cups and the like that he'd been presented with during his life as a captain bringing immigrants out. But there were lots of gaps in Henry's story, and Alistair decided he would love to flesh that story out for his own family, for the descendants of Henry Rose. And so he came to me for help. Alistair doesn't have the sort of online research skills that I do, and he knew that there was surely more information out there that we could add to the story, but he didn't know how to go about it. So that's where I came in.
So you've got the memoirs. They must have raised a lot of questions.
They certainly did. I mean, the very first few lines raised a lot of questions. It started with Henry writing that he was born in Mompox, Colombia, South America, on the 5th of December 1833, and ends with his father dying over there and his mother bringing them back. Well, that was only about 10 lines, but my gosh, there were a lot of questions. Why did the family go to Colombia in the 1830s? His father was a glover. He had made gloves, and then he became a stockbroker. So what were they doing from London to Colombia? So there was a very big question there. And the other thing was, what is Mompo? Where is Mompo? Well, we discovered that it is a small town. It's actually a World Heritage town now, way up the Magdalena River, which is Colombia's main river. And it flows from the Andes right out to the Caribbean Sea. And it was very difficult to get up that river to Mompo in the 1840s when Henry and his family were there. It's still really difficult to get to. So you can only imagine what on earth were they doing up there. So I had to do a lot of research about that part of the world to find out reasons why, what was going on, the political, the social scene, that sort of thing. Well, of course, it turned out that in the rise of a whole lot of independent states for independence from Spanish rule, there was a vacuum. And the British, of course, were very good at filling vacuums. And they came in and a whole support network grew up around them to support the military. And that was what Henry's father went to as he worked with the British War Office, not because there was a war going on, but he was there in a sort of a clerical role. And there is some suggestion that he may also have been an honorary consul over there as well. So Henry and his family were part of another move by the Brits, I suppose, to colonisation of another part of the world.
And one that we don't really hear about.
No, you don't. Here. You don't really. So it was a really interesting research project from that point of view, because I had no idea about that neck of the woods at all. But it brought up stories of corsairs and pirates and the fact that Mompo was established as a treasury because it was so far away from those pirates in the Caribbean Sea. And that's where the rich and powerful kept their treasure, really, their gold, their money, you know, it's where they made investments. And so a lot of trade built up in that tiny wee place where Henry Rose was born in 1833. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, how did he get to New Zealand? It's a long way away.
Well, that was a very long trip too, because when his father died, and we don't really know what he died of, but Eliza, his mother, was left with these children in the middle, literally, of nowhere. And she brought them back to England and he went off to school. It was his first formal schooling too, because his father had homeschooled him. And when he left at the age of 14, as they did in those days, you know, his mother in the lead up to that had been saying, what will we do with you? She needed to set him up in a career. And he had a dream, he wrote in his memoir. He had a dream that he went to sea and he mentioned this to her. So she got him on a trial voyage on a ship called the Orestes and they went into Cuba. And they had the most appalling weather, huge storms in the Bay of Biscay, and the cook, apparently, as the ship is being tossed around, said to Henry, you won't make it home to ever see your mother and sister again. And you'd think maybe he'd be put off by that. But actually, he was there with a lot of other young boys, cabin boys, and when it wasn't really rough, and that, they actually had a lot of fun. And Henry talks about what they used to do. You know, they used to row the captain over so he could have his meetings with all the rich and powerful people he needed to have meetings with. And the boys could just play around in the water and wander. And just they just had a great time. So he got back and said, I want to do this. I want to be a sailor. And so in time, he was apprenticed formally to the merchant navy and so started at the very low ranks and gradually worked his way up. And of course, the voyages he undertook, a story in themselves, it's really boy's own adventure stuff. He ended up going into China to get the tea, the brand new, newly picked tea. And so he was on clipper ships. The clipper ships were very fast. They'd travel down through the Southern Ocean dodging icebergs, but on the way back with the tea, they raced each other to be the first ones to London with the tea, because whoever was first got the best prices, of course. So these were very exciting and were followed at either end of the world, reading newspaper reports about who was going to be in first. It was, you know, so it's very exciting. You can just imagine being a young boy growing up and that sort of thing on board. He went into Australia taking convicts to Hobart and into Sydney. He witnessed his first flogging with the cat o' nine tails there, and he tells the story of how traumatic that was to witness some of the very worst convicts being sent up to Norfolk Island and how harsh that was on them. But he also brought female convicts out, and he talks about how in coming back in successive years he saw them working their way up and actually, of course, leaving and getting married and becoming settlers rather than convicts. So carving out a future for themselves, really. He also went through the Caribbean and up through the American seaboard. He brought coolies out from India. So coolies were indentured labour. Slavery had been disestablished, made illegal, but they still needed that labour, that cheap labour. So they brought indentured labourers out from India. And so he gradually worked his way up through third mate, second mate, first mate, and finally into master. And when he finally got his own ship, he was so excited. You can imagine, that I'm sure, you know, what it must be like to finally be in charge of your own ship. But it was a real dodgy ship. The captain in charge of it initially had let it run down, and this poor young new master going on board doing all what he thought were the right things, he gets sets off and finds all sorts of things are lacking. For example, yellow fever broke out on board, even though they had tried to get away from where it was before it got on board. It did. And he found there was no quinine. The stocks had run down and they hadn't been replaced and things like that. So he lost sailors. And then bad weather kept them back. And so they were running past their time and he was going to be fined. And he had to work his way out of it. And actually, the decisions he made proved to the owner he actually had initiative. He knew what he was doing and he could be trusted. So it was one of those rather fortunate voyages, tough though it was, I imagine. It kind of set him up. And it was from that sort of time, actually, that he started to bring immigrants out to New Zealand.
Sounds absolutely fascinating. Would you like to read us something from the book, please?
Perhaps I'll tell you about the Cat of Nine Tails, because that's something that a lot of people have mentioned. As third mate, Henry acted as purser and had charge of all the stores supplied by the government for the guards and convicts as well as for the ship. On arrival, he was required to give an account of the expenditure of government stores, for which service he received a gratuity of £15. I thought myself rather young for the position, having to issue the stores to the convicts, who sent two of their number in turn to see they got the proper quantity. We had to keep a sharp lookout to prevent their taking anything that they could lay their hands on. Captain Young thought me quite capable, having been with convicts before I knew what was required. The St. Vincent embarked the convicts and a guard of 50 rank and file with a captain, two lieutenants and two non-commissioned officers in December 1852. Convicts responsible for minor infringements were heard by the doctor, but a board made up of the ship's captain, the captain of the guard and the doctors heard serious cases. There was only one. Henry explained that it involved four convicts who stole a small carpenter's chisel and a dinner knife, which they fashioned into a saw. They cut through the deck and got into the storeroom, and Henry said they hoped to secure the magazine, although this was placed at the aft end of the ship. Instead, they helped themselves to some rum. On my going down in the morning, I at once saw that someone had been down during the night. After serving out the crew's stores, I had a look around and found out that they had cut through the deck and then taken down two planks of the bulkhead of the storeroom, which they replaced so it would not be noticed. The rum had its effects, so we had no trouble in finding out who had been down. The board sentenced them to receive two dozen strokes of the cat and be kept in leg irons for the remainder of the voyage. The cat refers to the notorious Cat of Nine Tails, a vicious multi-tailed whip used for severe physical punishment, most notably in the British Royal Navy and Army. The weapon's plaited and knotted tails were whipped across the beard, back or backside in a crisscross pattern of lashes that broke the skin. Punishment was usually administered ceremonial on board and often witnessed by the crew and convicts at the command of the captain. It is thought the Cat of Nine Tails, which was kept in a special bag, got its name from the scratches it left on a man's back. Ship's captains could order up to 24 lashes, and the punishment gave rise to well-known English expressions such as not enough room to swing a cat and letting the cat out of the bag. Even in the mid-19th century, the use of the Cat of Nine Tails was controversial. An autopsy report on August 4, 1846 said that Frederick John White had died after 150 lashes at the Hounslow Cavalry Barracks in England, with the mortal effects, including pulpy softening of the muscles and inflammation of internal organs. I well remember that afternoon, Henry wrote of the St. Vincent incident. It was a lovely afternoon, the whole of the guard stationed on the poop overlooking the main deck, the crew with loaded pistols on the main deck, the grating placed ready, the carpenter with the leg irons. The scene was a most impressive one. I had never seen a man flogged and shall never forget it. When all was ready, the whole of the convicts were called on deck to witness the punishment. The leader, a big burly Thames lighterman, was the first to go over for punishment, but he refused to move. Captain Anderson, the captain of the guard, walked up to the man and, placing his revolver close to the man's head, told him he would give him three chances and if he didn't walk over on the third, he would shoot him dead. You could have heard a pin drop, as the saying is, while Captain Anderson called out once, "Will you go?" Twice, "Will you go?" The convict all the time keeping his eye on the captain's, whose hand and voice were perfectly steady. The third time, as Captain Anderson said, "Will you go?" the man stepped out. Captain Anderson told us afterwards he never felt so glad as when that man stepped out, for in another moment he would have shot him dead, yet in appearance he seemed quite cool.
Criminals definitely have it a lot easier today.
They certainly do.
That is quite horrific. Mm. Now, the book is full of photos. How easy were they to source? Did the family have a lot of photos?
Well, no, they didn't actually. And I was quite surprised. Captain Henry, you know, he became a man of means, and I would have thought that there would have been far more family photographs, you know, studio portraits of them. Certainly there were of him. There were of his wife in her younger days, but of his children, we really found very few. And it was a bit frustrating, really. Henry ended up being on the Wellington Harbour Board when that was established. And so there were several from that period of time as a younger man and then just as he retired. But it was quite difficult. And a non-fiction book, to me, pictures make it. You know, I think you need images. A book that's just endless words is quite hard, I think, to attract readers. So the more images you have that illustrate it, the better. So we did have to go searching, and we sourced them from all sorts of places, overseas and here. I mean, obviously museums and libraries, the Royal Maritime Museum in London, a whole lot that just to illustrate Henry's story, really. And I think it looks really good. It's quite surprising when you look at the book when it was all laid up. Oh, actually, we do have quite a few images now. It was fantastic.
Yeah, it definitely brings the book alive.
Yeah.
Now, the song you have chosen today is Tammy Nielsen's Big Boss Mama. Why?
Well, I love Tammy. I've followed Tammy for a number of years now, and she is just this amazing, amazing woman. She's got a big voice, and I just love her. And she's coming to the Arts Festival again on the 21st of October.
I had that down to mention.
Yeah, and so, of course, I'm going. And this is her latest single, Big Boss Mama, and it's a homage to strong and powerful women in history and now. And if you see the video, it references Cleopatra and Elizabeth I and women who broke boundaries like Amelia Earhart and Annie Oakley. Courageous women who battled injustice like Rosa Parks and Joan of Arc, and even women who've influenced her directly, and she includes Jacinda Ardern in there, and I just think that's fabulous, so I just love it.
Right, let's listen to the wonderful Tammy Nielsen's Big Boss Mama.
Mouthful of sass in a shake in my ass, like a 57 Chevy baby built to last. Bringing home the paycheck, singing on your tape deck. Mama makes the babies and the dinner and the cash. Ooh. Rules, I make a man, I break them. Fools, my mama didn't raise them. I'm a big boss mama,
a big boss mama.
All the drama. Ooh. Rules, I make them and I break them. Fools, my mama didn't raise them. I'm a big boss mama,
a big boss mama,
a big boss mama.
I'm a big boss mama.
Pay the band a rocket, put the money in my pocket, and I'm blowing up the stage like a Saturn V rocket. Ooh. Get down, run for cover. Ooh. Look out, she's a big boss mama. And the drum kicks high, so
Thank you so much, Karen, for talking with us today. Karen's latest book, Driven by the Wind, the memoir of Captain Henry Rose, published by River Press, is available from all good bookshops. I'm Galen Pound, and you've been listening to Top Writers. A podcast of this program and upcoming events can be found on www.topwriters.co.nz.
Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this podcast available by funding the Access Internet Radio Project. Other great local programs from Fresh FM are available through the Access Internet Radio app or our website, freshfm.net.